May it please the court. Philip Rogner from Potter, Anderson, and Caroon for the appellees, with the exception of EBF. With me is my co-counsel from Quinn Emanuel, Nicholas Joseph, please rise, Sean Baldwin, and Alicia Cobb.
Welcome.
Mr. Joseph will be presenting the argument on behalf of all appellees.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Garrett Moritz from Sykes Ross on behalf of Appellee EBF and Associates LP. Mr. Joseph will be presenting the argument for all of the appellees today, but I'm present if there are any EBF specific questions. Thank you.
May it please the court, Catherine Dearlove from Richards, Leighton & Finger on behalf of the Appellant Quadrant Structured Products Company. With me today, I'd like to introduce to the court my co-counsel, Mr. Sabin Willett from the Bingham McCutcheon firm. Mr. Willett will be presenting argument today. His colleague, Mr. Sam Rowley. My partner, Russell Silberglied from Richards, Leighton & Finger. And with the indulgence of the court behind the bar, Ms. Sue Hannigan, also of Richards, Leighton & Finger.
Welcome all.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. This appeal concerns the construction of a contract, and specifically Section 7.06 of the Athlon indentures. Now, Vice Chancellor Laster thought the issue so clearly controlled by two decisions of the Chancery Court that literally nothing more needed to be said than the citations to Feldbaum and Lange. But Feldbaum and Lange construed different contracts with importantly different words. So I thought it might be well to start this afternoon with looking at the words in our contract. They appear at page A131 of your appendices. And the key phrase in this text is as follows: by virtue or by availing of any provision of this indenture. That is the class of cases that must route through the trustee procedure before commencing. A right that arises by virtue or by availing of any provision of this indenture. What's missing from that language are three words: or the securities, which were present in the Feldbaum indenture, present in Lange, present in Timberlands, indeed present in the 11th Circuit's review of Akenthos. Now, it may be asked, are those significant words? Do they matter? They have mattered to courts. They mattered to Judge Free when he sat in the Southern District of New York construing an indenture and having to explain why he found that the bar applied to a case when the Second Circuit, in a decision called Cruden, had said that tort claims, non-contractual claims, were not barred by the clause. And the answer was, it's a different clause. He said that clause had the phrase, or the securities, mine doesn't. And Chancellor Allen specifically refers to that in his Feldbaum decision. He says, I agree, that's right. And then he refers to the note holder status of the plaintiff in that case as being the hook that brings in the non-contractual claims. So too of Vice Chancellor Strein in Lange. He refers to ownership of the debentures being the hook for the state law claims. In fact, it's hard to find a case that has come out for the defendants below, the appellees here, on this point that doesn't have that hook or the security. Sometimes it's phrased or the notes. And we don't have that.
I think we understand that the broad issue is whether whether this action is foreclosed by the no action clause in the indenture. I have a couple of questions. The Court of Chancery found that it was, relying on two prior Chancery cases, Feldbaum and Lange. In this case, the issue is governed by New York law. Is that
correct? That is correct, Your Honor.
And that was also the case in Lange and Feldbaum.
I believe so,
yes. Delaware court construing, trying to fathom what the New York law was and then apply it to whatever the facts were. So would it be fair to say that the issue before us is whether the Court of Chancery properly applied New York law?
Yes, Your Honor.
If, in fact, this case were governed by Feldbaum and Lay, then my question is, do those cases, in those factual circumstances, properly apply New York law?
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer is maybe, but it doesn't matter because they're construing different contracts.
I understand, but the application that was given to the no action clause in the Feldbaum case, and I guess by extension in Lang, was very broad.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it didn't involve parsing through particular language that either was or wasn't there in the no action clause in those cases.
Well,
and so the question is, and we're not determining Delaware law as an ultimate matter. We're trying to fathom New York law. And the question is, do the New York cases, apart from Lang and apart from Feldbaum, do they endorse an analysis that parses through the specific language the way that you are doing here in your briefs?
Yes, Your Honor. Three cases come to mind, two from New York, one from Delaware. The Cruden case, which is a Second Circuit decision, says the no action clause in that case does not bar the kinds of claims that we brought. And in Cruden, there was no reference to the securities. Victor versus Rickless, which is a Southern District of New York construing New York law, says that's the key point. My indenture does have the or the securities language, and on that hook, I dropped this. And the third case was a learned decision from the Chancery Court called Continental Illinois. Your Honor may be familiar with that. You wrote it some years ago, in which, admittedly, reading tea leaves of the then Delaware Supreme Court, you concluded that those decisions implicitly held that there was not an overbroad reading of these no-action clauses. They didn't reach fraudulent transfer claims and tort claims. Your decision was of a piece, frankly, with Justice Berger's decision when she sat on that court in a case called Mabon Nugent, which is cited by our opponents in their brief, and in which Your Honor said, look, this clause applies to the contract claims. It does not apply to the other claims. And that is the right reading, particularly where we lack that or the securities language, Justice Jacobs. The other problem, the sort of systemic problem with the argument of my colleagues, is that the logic of these indentures is that the individual bondholder cannot bring the claim because the trustee can, and it should be for the trustee to exercise that discretion. But here we've not alleged a claim that the trustee can bring. Our indenture is very specific about the limitations on the trustee's ability to go to remedies. It must be a defined event of default. We've not alleged one here. And so making the demand that they suggest, the trustee wouldn't be able to proceed with it.
Well, it's a cogent argument. I understand it. The problem is what we have to do is to fathom how that argument would fly if it were brought in before the New York courts.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. And I think Judge Freeze, it may be footnote 7 of that Victor Rickless opinion, is the best guidance on that, where he says that the real difference is you need the parties to have expressed in their contract that claims that devolve from ownership of the securities are also subject to this bar. I think it's worth pointing out as well that these parties, in this case, opted for this form of indenture. I think it was 2 years or so after Lang came down, reaffirming Feldbaum. Those decisions are pretty well known in the investment community. The decision to opt for this form of words that excises securities and not the other, it seems material that everyone would have been aware that using the other form of words would lead to the no action clause going beyond the causes of action in the contract.
That's a somewhat unusual argument in the sense that we have these two Delaware cases construing New York law, and you're saying that Delaware's construction of New York law was informing how agreements were being drafted?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. Many cases are litigated in the Delaware courts, and when the courts of Chancery or the Court of Chancery, if this court speaks, you often interpret New York agreements. Everyone's paying attention. Now, obviously, they're paying attention to the New York courts, too. But it is true that several years before this indenture, the Vice Chancellor in Lange said, when you have those words or the securities, I should say he construed a contract that had those words, in the other side's favor, and now we have a different set of words in our contract. One point I'd like to emphasize as well, I don't think there's any case anywhere that has applied one of these contractual bars to a derivative claim, which is, it's not our claim to bring, it's a claim that belongs to the company. And there isn't a word in this indenture that suggests that an indenture trustee could ever act as the steward for the company, advancing the company's rights against third parties. Now, it's not to say parties might not in some other contract make that agreement, but they didn't make it here. We never delegated to the trustee the power in insolvency to stand as the spokesperson, the representative of the company to bring those kinds of claims. So that would be a first. We believe it was a first by the Vice Chancellor below.
At the risk of retreading some area that we covered a few minutes ago, but just to, from the interest of precision, is it your position that that Feldbaum and Lange were correct insofar as they applied to the language of the indentures in those respective cases?
Your Honor, I
or
think
or would you are you contending that even in that regard they were wrongly decided?
I would prefer to say that you don't need to reach the question because they are construing different contracts. It is still a stretch to pin the claims that we have made on the mere ownership of the securities. But if the court is persuaded that that analysis of Chancellor Allen was correct, then you can rule in our favor without questioning the validity of those decisions.
The primary argument is that right or wrong, those two decisions don't read on this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so it was error to cite them as direct authority.
It clearly,
without dealing with the differences.
It clearly was error. You know, I submit it was error for the Vice Chancellor to cite them without commenting on the fact that they deal with different words in the contract. No effort was made to explain what words in our contract give rise to a waiver of claims that don't arise from the contract, that arise from the law of Delaware under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act or under this court's Jawala decision.
Now, you haven't mentioned yet Tang Capital. Are you going to address why that is inapplicable?
Let me turn now to Tang, Your Honor. Tang is problematic. Every time I read it, I scratch my head a different way, and I'll tell you two reasons. The first is, Vice Chancellor Glasscock, in order to construct the language in that indenture, which is similar to but not precisely identical to ours, in order to construct the language the way he did, he had to literally insert commas. Here's the language again. By virtue or by availing of any provision of this indenture. So it's a direct reference to provisions of the indenture. He leaps from virtue over the intervening words to indenture, inserting commas, you can see it in the opinion, that aren't there along the way. That's simply not a proper reading of the English words that were before him. So that's one issue. The second perplexing issue is that when the Vice Chancellor was, when it was suggested to him by the plaintiffs that they had left the plaintiffs without a remedy, he said, no, I didn't leave you without a remedy. I considered and found not to be colorable your breach of fiduciary duty claims. Well, in a post-Jawala world, those claims had to be derivative. So if the court reached them, then the Tang derivative claims, like ours, would not have been barred by the very provision that he was construing in the no-action clause. The third thing to comment about Tang, the thing that clearly was of concern to the Vice Chancellor, I believe, was that that's a receivership case. And you have an operating business. They have a pharmaceutical product that has been approved by the FDA. There's a question about whether to continue marketing it. You're going to the extreme remedy of receivership. And frankly, there was a little gamesmanship by the plaintiffs in terms of trying to gin up a default, all of which was of concern to the Chancery Court when it denied the relief requested. So I don't think that Tang is persuasive, particularly on its construction of language that required the court to insert commas that are not present. And the Vice Chancellor also didn't deal in that case, nor did Vice Chancellor Lasseter in this, with the fact that the indentures separately define indenture, it's a defined term, and security. And the definitions don't reference each other. They're separate things. So the significant contractual point is that the parties omitted reference in our indenture to the securities. I would add just there are other points to raise about the language of the indenture as well. 7.07, for example, is a section that often appears in these indentures that makes clear that there's the granting or reserving of one right doesn't limit others. That appears at A132. There was no treatment of that section below. And when you look at section 7.01, I did want to address one point that my colleagues made in their briefs, the question of whether event of default is a defined term at certain points in the indenture. If you go back to 7.06, which is at A131, after explaining what limited class of cases are subject to the bar, the language goes on to say what you have to do if you are subject to the bar. And it says that you have to give the trustee a notice of the default, small d, and of the continuance thereof as herein before provided. Well, herein before provided is a reference to this document, this contract. And there are no continuances of default herein before provided except the events of default that appear in 7.01. So this language is clearly referring back to the limited specific list of things that can give rise to the right of a trustee to bring an action.
So as I understand your position, if we look at the document, everything would lead us to conclude if you have a problem that's relating to the document or the securities, then you have to go through the trustee. But that to the extent this action is a derivative action, it clearly had nothing to do with anything relating to the document. And it has, after Juwala, simply to do with your standing as a creditor to bring the suit. And in the absence of the more expansive language from the other cases that would say something about bringing a suit relating to this document or arising from your ownership of securities, that you can go forward with a derivative suit.
Yes, I agree with almost everything you said, Your Honor, but at the early part of, as you phrased that, you included the phrase, or the securities, as in referring to the document, when in fact the document doesn't refer to the
securities. No, I understand
but,
that.
But I agree that what's different about this case is we have a different contract, and nothing in this contract or any of the contracts says that bondholders have waived or have assigned to the trustee the narrow right that arises in a Juwala situation where you have insolvency. If the court please, I'm on to my rebuttal period, so I'll sit down.
All right.
Good afternoon. Nicholas Joseph with Quinn Emanuel for Athlon, the Athlon Board, and Asia. The no action clause here bars all of Quadrant's claims because they cover any claim that a noteholder may assert by virtue of its status as a noteholder. All Athlon noteholders hold these claims ratably, and the alleged harm on which they're based derives entirely from harm to the issuer. It has been settled law for over 20 years that noteholders may assert such claims only if they comply with the no action clause. This rule avoids wasteful litigation, protects noteholders from litigation they do not support, and prevents claim splitting. Quadrant's own claims illustrate why no action clauses were created. Athlon issued its notes in 2004, but Quadrant purchased them less than 2 years ago, after all of the conduct about which it complains, including the acquisition by EBF, the allegedly excessive fees to Asia, and the challenge to Athlon's operating and the change to Athlon's operating guidelines. This is, in other words, a strike suit. To allow a single bondholder to pursue such claims without complying with the no-action clause would disrupt 20 years of precedent. Quadrant, by contrast, is looking for a phantom.
You say 20 years of precedent. Do you
yes.
mean 20 years of precedent in the Delaware courts or 20 years of precedent of the New York courts?
It's 20 years of precedent in Delaware and other states. There are not very many New York cases that consider no action clauses. And
the reading that we would have to give to the case law would be extremely broad and almost untethered to the language of the contract. And that may be appropriate if that's what the New York courts require.
Well,
that's
the
question.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Willett pointed to the language of the no-action clause. Here is the starting point, and that's one point on which we agree. If you look at
the languages,
that the language of the no-action clause is the starting
point. I would hope so, yeah.
So it's at 7.06 at A131-32, and the full language is, any right by virtue of or availing of any provision of this indenture to institute any proceeding at law or in equity or in bankruptcy or otherwise upon or under or with respect to this indenture. I'd like to focus on the phrases by virtue of or availing of and upon or under or with respect to.
Let's cut through this for a moment. We understand that the bondholders are bondholders by virtue of the indenture, but they're not suing to enforce any provision of the indenture. There's no event of default that's been declared. You know, there are other conditions, for under the no action clause or provision that, that are not implicated here. And yet the argument seems to be that simply because their rights as creditors arose under the indenture, that's all that's needed. If that's true, then when could bondholders ever bring an action of any kind without complying with the no action clause? Or to put it differently, can there ever be an independent action of any kind brought by the bondholders?
Yes, there can. When the cause of action is based on harm that is individual to the bondholder, not mm-hmm. when the harm derives from harm to the issuer.
So only if they weren't paid the principal or interest that was due under the terms of the bond?
Or if there were a fraudulent inducement claim. In other words, a fraudulent inducement claim.
Well, that would void the whole indenture, wouldn't it?
It would be a claim that was individual to the note holder and therefore would not and doesn't derive from harm to the issuer and would not be covered by the no action clauses we're considering. That isn't to say that parties couldn't enter into agreements to cover those kinds of claims. There's no limitation on a party's ability to restrict its rights, other than, for example, the restriction that federal securities law claims can't be assigned. But parties could theoretically agree to that, and I'd like to focus on the language here to show that that is, in fact, what the parties did agree to. The phrase upon or under or with respect to this indenture is not a phrase a party would use if the party meant only a claim under the indenture. This is much broader language. This is meant to encompass any kind of claim with respect to a party's status as a note holder. If it were restricted to claims under the indenture, it would clearly say that. Upon or under or with respect to the indenture is not a way of saying only with respect to breaches of the indenture.
Is there a New York case that supports that construction?
There is not one of which I'm aware, no. However, the case on which Quadrant primarily relies, Victor v. Rickless, doesn't compel a different result here for three primary reasons. First, in Victor, the court held that the plaintiff's tort claims were barred by the no-action clause, the very result that Quadrant argues against here. Second, it misinterpreted the Second Circuit case on which it purported to base this distinction between no-action clauses that included the phrase "and securities" and no-action clauses that didn't, and that's Cruden.
Well, how do we know that the Vice Chancellor agreed with that, disagreed with that? Many times we'll have chancery opinions that might be 100 pages long, but this is barely 100 words long. So has the court addressed the argument that the absence of the word "or the securities," as the other side has argued, in any way? Are we speculating here?
No, Your Honor, because it's actually addressed in Feldbaum. Feldbaum discusses Victor v. Rickless, and it brushes aside the distinction that Victor v. Rickless makes. The Vice Chancellor in Feldbaum recognized that the court in Victor misinterpreted Cruden. In Cruden, the Second Circuit didn't base its decision on a distinction between a no-action clause that included "and the securities" and a no-action clause that merely said "indenture." In fact, it doesn't even discuss that distinction. Instead, it held, and this is at page 968, it would be absurd to require the debenture holders to ask the trustee to sue itself. In other words, the reason that Cruden did not give effect to the no-action clause was not because of a difference in wording, but because of the identity of the defendant. And Vice Chancellor Allen recognized this in Feldbaum. At 7 in note 12, he said, even if there had been no difference between the no-action clauses addressed in the two cases, i.e. the no-action clause interpreted in Cruden had been as broad as that considered in Victor, the cases would likely still have come out differently. Application of the no-action clause in Cruden still may well have been appropriate because the trustee in Cruden was accused of impropriety. In Victor, as here, no such conflict was alleged. In other words, Vice Chancellor Allen went out of his way to note that the distinction on which Victor relied was not the basis of not a basis recognized in New York law. Both Feldbaum and Victor are also over 20 years old, and there's a reason they're about the same age. It's because they were interpreting the same no-action clause. But it is Feldbaum that courts follow, not Victor, not just in Delaware, but across the country. Whereas Victor's a curiosity.
But do you agree the no-action clause here is different?
It is different in wording, but it is the same in intent. The intent is to cover all claims by virtue of a noteholder's status as a noteholder. I'd also like
That's the issue, isn't it?
Yes. And it is broader because of the language that I cited, which was not present in Lange or Feldbaum or Timberlands II, the upon or under or with respect to by virtue of or availing of. These phrases all weren't present in those indentures, which makes this indenture different and therefore broader, because this is broadening language. Those indentures just refer to the indenture and the securities. And one's rights as a security holder derive entirely from an indenture. If there's any redundancy, it's the inclusion of the phrase "and securities," because securities are creatures of the indenture.
But the question is whether that is an argument that would have traction in the New York courts.
I think it would, Your Honor, because New York courts, as Delaware courts, pay close attention to the language of the contractual provision and do not interpret that language to render parts of it inoperative. Quadrant has offered no explanation of what those phrases mean, of why this no-action clause is different from the no-action clauses in Feldbaum, Lange, and Timberlands II. That language must mean something. It cannot simply be that the parties put in that language in order to get a longer no-action clause. They put it in for a reason. It was because they wanted to ensure that any claim arising out of one's status as a note holder was covered by the no-action clause.
But there's no New York case that you can point to that validates that construction.
That's correct, but Tang validates that construction. Tang explicitly held that by virtue of the indenture indicates coverage of such causes of action available to a plaintiff by virtue of its status as a note holder.
But the Vice Chancellor did not cite Tang, did he?
The Vice Chancellor did not cite Tang. But Tang was actually decided after the Vice Chancellor issued his opinion, so he could not have.
Do I understand you basically to be saying that the phrase upon or under or with respect to in the no action clause is the equivalent of or securities as argued by opposing counsel, that somehow that language brings the no action provision beyond the note itself and also encompasses an action involving the corporation?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the language, and in addition, by virtue of and availing of, both indicate an intention by the parties for the no action clause to cover more than simply breaches of the indenture. And if there were any doubt about what the parties intended here, we can look to the private placement memoranda. These were written at the same time as the indenture by the same people, and their sole purpose is to explain the transaction. And the private placement memoranda state that the no action clauses cover, and I'm quoting, rights under the indenture and the notes. That's precisely the language that Quadrant is pointing to as differentiating this no action clause from the no action clauses in Lang and Feldbaum. And there's no, Quadrant can provide no explanation of why the PPMs would indicate a different coverage of the no action clause here than the indenture would. And in fact, they wouldn't do so. What this language in the PPMs shows is that these are two different ways of putting the same thing, which is that the coverage of the no action clause is meant to extend to note holder status claims. The structure of the indenture also confirms that that all claims by virtue of one's status as a note holder are covered by the no action clause. As Quadrant admits, note holders are not permitted to take actions that adversely affect other note holders under the no action clause itself. The primary control on this is the requirement that a note holder obtain the support of half of other note holders. This is in the no action clause itself, but that's only one example. In fact, the indenture never allows a note holder to take actions that affect other note holders unless at least 50% of them agree. I can give four examples. 7.02F at A126 to 27 allows declaration of all principal immediately due and payable upon a certain event of default, but only if 50% of security holders agree. 8.02D at A135 does not require the trustee to act upon a direction of security holders unless 50% of them do the directing. 8.02F, also at A135, does not require the trustee to make a factual investigation absent an event of default and written request by 50% of security holders. 8.09C at A138 does not allow the removal of the trustee except by 50% of security holders. Allowing suits by individual note holders that affect the rights of all note holders would completely undermine this scheme. Quadrant's own suit demonstrates this. In its demand letter to the affluent board...
How do you apply that concept to a derivative claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where the only effect of the claim, if it's successful, is to increase the size of the pie. It doesn't have any direct impact on the rights of note holders, qua note holders.
But it is by virtue of one's status as a note holder that one has standing to assert a derivative claim. Therefore, the right to assert a derivative claim is still shared ratably by all note holders and affects all of them in the same fashion. Now, this is clearly correct because any claim asserted on behalf of debt holders is derivative in the sense that it derives from harm to the issuer. The only difference between the so-called direct claims here and the derivative claims is the identity of the defendant. In fact, both Feldbaum and RBC make this point. They both describe the harm suffered by security holders in those so-called direct actions as derivative. It's at page 8 in Feldbaum and at page 2 in RBC. And Quadrant offers no cogent reason why derivative claims should be treated any differently from direct claims, and its own complaint shows that the risks associated with treating derivative claims differently from direct claims is even stronger. Quadrant asserts two claims, constructive dividends and civil conspiracy, both directly and derivatively. If the no-action clause applied to direct claims and not to derivative claims, those two claims would necessarily be split, even though they are based on the same facts and, in fact, largely the same allegations. Apologize. And Quadrant doesn't have the support of any other note holders. Now, Quadrant asserts that the other note holders are simply free riders. If that were true, Quadrant would have no trouble securing their support. And those other note holders don't have to hire counsel. They don't have to supply an indemnity. They don't have to do anything other than say yes. But Quadrant hasn't even taken the first step of obtaining their consent. The fair conclusion is that Quadrant has no support. And it's more appropriate to give effect to the no-action clause here than it may be in other situations because Athlon has a board of directors and active management. When purchasing the Athlon notes, one is purchasing management of the company. Thus, one shouldn't allow a single debt holder to usurp the role of management and directors. Now, Quadrant has questioned the power of the trustee to bring a suit absent an event of default. But the parties here deliberately did not use the defined term event of default in the no action clause. Instead, the clause simply requires notice of a default, which is an undefined term, and whatever it is, it certainly is not an event of default. And under Quadrant's own reading of the indenture, it has alleged a default of the indenture. At page 7 of its reply brief, Quadrant admits that default at least encompasses a breach of the indenture. And Quadrant alleges such a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is count 7 at A51. So Quadrant could have, under its own reading of the no-action clause, alleged the default necessary for the trustee to take action. But the court needn't rule on such narrow a ground. The only way to reach this question is if you accept that the no-action clause applies to non-indenture claims. And if it does, there's no reason to impose the arbitrary trigger of an unrelated event of default. This provision in the indenture is a notice requirement. It puts the trustee on notice of the conduct about which the note holder complains. This allows the trustee to evaluate whether to bring suit pursuant to the direction of the note holder. To require in a situation where the event of default or default was unrelated to the conduct about which the note holder is complaining that there also be an event of default would simply not serve the purposes of the parties. There's also no logic to the distinction that Quadrant presses between claims under the indenture and claims not under the indenture. Quadrant identifies no reason why allowing note holders to bring claims that affect all of them ratably would conform to the party's expectations or why it would be good policy. But Feldbaum does explain why treating claims under the indenture and claims not under the indenture the same way serves the intentions of the parties and policy, because the rule ensures that note holders support any claims that affect all of them, and because this construction discourages unmeritorious suits, specifically strike suits like Quadrant's. The Timberlands II court identified another policy reason why no action clauses should be interpreted this way. This is at 943, note 39. It discourages claim splitting. If no action clauses bar contract claims but not any other kind, then trustees must proceed with contract claims while individual note holders may pursue non-contractual claims, possibly on the same facts. I would offer three more reasons in support. First, Quadrant's rule would turn the no-action clause into a mere pleading requirement rather than a substantive rule, because many contractual claims can be recast as tort claims. Second, Quadrant's rule would allow not just for claim splitting, but for competing suits by different note holders under the same facts, possibly asserting the same claims, with no mechanism of deciding which note holder suit should proceed, or if the suits are combined, which note holder should control the suit. Third, the rule in Feldbaum allows for the efficient resolution of complex cases, serving the purpose of no action clauses, which are meant to conserve the parties and judicial resources. That it was because the law of no action clauses was so well settled that Vice Chancellor Laster was able to dispose of this case in a short opinion and without holding oral argument. And Vice Chancellor Strine also noted how complex the legal issues were in Lange, but was able to resolve the case entirely on the no action clause, which, as he put it at page 5, disposes of the motion most efficiently.
Was there a briefing below of the length and magnitude that has been presented to us?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. Some of that briefing is included in the appendix. The parties devoted a significant portion of that brief to the application of the no action clause, but also to other issues. There are significant other issues relating to these claims that would also also require dismissal, but the Vice Chancellor didn't need to reach them because the no action clause here disposed of all of them efficiently.
I have another question on that. In terms of the decision below, I gather from what you're saying that the distinction between the language in the Feldman and the Lange case and the language in this case, that distinction was brought to the Vice Chancellor's attention, and the purported meaning of the or securities language, which is lacking here, was brought to the attention of the Vice Chancellor as well. But what we have as a decision is just, this is the answer, without any discussion of why the difference in the language makes no difference in the result. Are we just supposed to figure that out ourselves?
Well, Your Honor, if anyone is at fault for that, it's Quadrant. Quadrant did not raise the distinction between the no action clauses in Feldbaum, Lang, Timberlands 2, and others, and the no action clause here to the Vice Chancellor. Quadrant raised that issue for the first time on appeal. We've provided arguments as to it, but I would submit that if the distinction were so obvious based on the language, it is an argument that Quadrant would have raised before the Vice Chancellor. But because it was Quadrant's failure to do so, this court is entitled not to consider that distinction if it wishes to, and certainly there is no basis for sending the case back to the Vice Chancellor to consider a distinction that Quadrant did not bother to raise before him in the first place.
So the argument is it was waived, that issue?
If it was not waived, it should at least be taken with the same seriousness that Quadrant has supplied, which is not raising it before the Vice Chancellor. We have addressed it. We consider it to be incorrect. The Feldbaum, Lang, Timberlands 2, and all of the other Delaware cases to consider this issue have not put weight on this distinction, and we submit it's because that distinction makes no difference here.
Have you argued before now that it was waived?
We argued in our briefs that it was waived. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My colleague referred, I think, twice to our suit being a strike suit. I won't dwell on that. But the gist of it, I suppose, is that we are late comers to the bonds.
our colleagues are latecomers to the equity, too. Everybody in this courtroom is a latecomer, and I submit that we're all bound by the rules that governed at the outset. We don't have more
Can
or less.
Can we focus on the last comment, which is that this or securities language argument was not raised below?
Yes, Your Honor. A289 is one of several pages in our brief to Vice Chancellor Laster, where we, to use the words of your Supreme Court Rule 8, we fairly presented the issue. We said the indenture, meaning our indenture, citing to 7.06, never refers to rights or claims other than defined contractual events of default. That's the argument that we're making to you here. It's the same argument we made below. What my colleague is saying is that we failed to identify a distinction in the Feldbaum and Lange cases. And we discussed other problems with the Feldbaum and Lange cases, like in both of them there was an event of default. But I don't know any rule of waiver that says I have to identify every distinction with a case that's not on all fours with my case. What I have to present to the Vice Chancellor is the legal argument that we were depending on, which is the words of our contract don't go beyond events of default. To come back to a point, Justice Jacobs, that you raised, I think it's very important, this notion that you heard several times in the last argument, that all of our claims are claims made ratably for the bondholders. It's not true of the derivative claims. If we prevail in a derivative claim and the company obtains either money or the benefit of an injunction, then that benefit may or may not roll down to our bondholders. It depends on their order of priority in the company, and it depends on the solvency of the company. That benefit will go to the company. That's different than Feldbaum. It's different than any case that's been cited to you. My colleague kept saying that the language in our indenture gets to the same place, and I just don't understand that. The phrase in Feldbaum is, with respect to this indenture or the securities. Same in Lange, same in Acantha, same in Timberlands. Our phrase is, by virtue or availing of any provision of this indenture. And then it talks about lawsuits arising under with respect to, again, this indenture. No reference to the securities. I don't understand that reading.
I think the argument is that because your the bondholder's status, very existence as bondholders, can only be attributed to the indenture. That is, that they exist as bondholders only by virtue of the indenture.
That's an excessively broad reading of the word indenture when you're talking about an instrument that separately defines securities. And it's not the one that Judge Free specifically identified as saying, my indenture has or the securities. And the Second Circuit's in Cruden did not. That was the difference to him. And I don't think I'm misreading Chancellor Allen's opinion to say he agreed with that expressly in his opinion. One other point I wanted to get to. My colleague mentioned the purchase price memorandum, or the memo that was distributed, the private placement memo, in connection with the bonds. If we were to have the argument made that this clause was ambiguous, we would have been able to put in all the evidence that surrounded it. Nothing like that happened in the Court of Chancery. So you can't pluck one line out of a private placement memo, but if my colleague can pluck one, I can pluck another, which appears at page B204 of your appendix. The standard language that you see that says if there's anything in this memo that's different than the documents control and you are referred to the documents. So if some guy at Lehman Brothers got it wrong, that doesn't change our rights under the document. The argument was made about the implied covenant case. We're not aware of any case in which a trustee has gone to remedies under the theory that an implied covenant was a breach of an express covenant under an indenture. That would be new. So the notion that that works, we think, is incorrect. But if we're wrong about that, the Vice Chancellor would presumably drop that claim. Count 7, I think it is.
below. That's as far as that takes you. Some provisions of the indenture were mentioned in terms of the necessity of 50% to instruct the trustee. All of them had to do with the direct function of the trustee, except one. The trustee can't be made to give a direction. He can't be sacked. There was another one, unless you have 50%. We're not trying to interfere with the trustee's actions, so the Section 8 references are not germane. The only other one was acceleration. We're not trying to accelerate. It bears emphasis in the minute that remains to me how unusual this corporation and this situation is. My colleague said they have a board and they have a management. There's no business. They haven't had a business for 4 years. All they do, literally, is pay interest on the bonds and collect premiums on an existing portfolio of what amount to insurance policies. They don't write new business. They don't analyze credit default swaps. They're just sitting there with these pile of assets that are dramatically less in value than their liabilities. And they have corporate organization documents that we have flagged and that are in the appendices that are limited. They don't have the usual language that they can engage in any lawful business. They say the business of this company is limited. And they refer to a specific set of operating guidelines, and they say we need to be AAA rated and so on. This is a unique corporation formed for a unique purpose that finds itself in a situation where the late comers on the equity side can wait out the bonds for 25 years and essentially reverse the priorities that were set at the outset. That's the case we wanted to try before the Chancellor. That's the case that I hope this court will permit us to go back to try. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.